These guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Tuesday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Let's jump right in. John Najarian is on a phone line, joins us from CNBC in the Halftime Report. Also, the Najarian Family Office is John Najarian. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you, Stephen. Great to be with you,
so
sir.
Maybe we got as warm of an embrace as we could expect from President Trump. He said that he doesn't really like it, but he also said he doesn't see a government shutdown over this latest compromise. What do you make of all that?
I think it certainly helped just the rumors of it before we actually heard it from himself, of course, on our tape delay here. But when we heard rumors that he was leaning that way, the market took it as a very positive in the pre-market, and we've just built on that sentiment throughout the day. We're literally pennies away from the high of the day right now, up over 340 points.
And so this is about the budget compromise, or is this about what's going on with China? Because I hear there's more optimism with China, but then I also hear that they might extend the deadline because they're so far apart.
I think both could be true.
Okay.
They've also discussed Xi Jinping showing up down at Mar-a-Lago in March for face-to-face negotiations with the president, which, again, those kind of negotiations are very rare, but not so with this president. So rather than just having his team work it out, there might be a little bit of that, and that is providing a little more optimism as well. I'd say, and my brother Pete said this today too, it's probably 30% China today and 70% avoidance of a government shutdown and moving ahead with financing. I think that's probably about the right way to view it. But if we get a framework for a deal, I think we could go significantly higher in the market.
Have you been watching the ruble today at all? I don't know if you have, but it's been negative, and they said that they think there are more U.S. sanctions coming against Russia.
I have not, but one of the ways that frequently we'll see that play out is with some of the metals, whether it's the aluminum companies like Alcoa, which is showing a very nice gain today, and, of course, Deripaska, I think, is how you pronounce the gentleman's name,
yeah,
that is the head of their biggest aluminum company in Russia. So what if there are sanctions against them, and they have to buy from the rest of the world, not from one of the largest producers out of Russia, that's certainly good for all of the other companies. So it could very well be that that is what's playing out today, Stephen.
Let's talk whiskey a little bit. Would you? You wouldn't mind that, would you?
Love it. I love it.
The Distilled Spirits Council came out with their numbers, and it was being played in showing that how the tariff war hurt the distillery industry last year, the whiskey industry. But I'm not sure that they've got a case. It says globally during the first 6 months of 2018, U.S. exports of American whiskeys were growing at 28%. So they were up 28%. Following the retaliatory tariffs, those exports dropped 8.2%. So they're saying the tariffs hurt business. But overall, they had a record year, $1.7 billion in exports through November. Now, listening to you, what that tells me was that they just had an extraordinary first 6 months because they knew the tariffs were coming in the second 6 months.
Exactly right, sir. That is exactly what they do with any commodity or any product that they know are going to get slapped with tariffs. There's a rush to import that into your country before
right.
the tariffs kick in. So that would explain precisely that 28% jump, which is dramatic. Usually these are single-digit sort of moves. But instead, the first 6 months being $595 million, that's huge. And I would say you're exactly right about how that played out. They were pre-ordering.
What are you watching today, John? I know Boeing is doing well, and Under Armour was up today.
Boeing's doing really well. Sealy Temper, or Temper Sealy, whichever way you'd like to say it. They're a mattress company. They have earnings due out on Thursday this week. A lot of upside call buying in this one. It's made a nice, better than nice, a great move from 41 to 53. Now it's pushing to $54 a share, and we show upside bets believing that it's going to be somewhere close to 60 perhaps by the end of the week.
What
so we were buying that one.
What do they sell, John? Because it seems to me like the world is, I know they sell mattresses, but I mean, the world is moving toward these sort of mail order foam mattresses, aren't they? I think of Sealy as someone you go to a store for.
True, but the combination of the Tempur-Pedic mattress, which is part of their name now, is that they do indeed make those foam mattresses for others to sell under different brands and things like that. So, obviously, they make their biggest bucks on the high-end mattresses that Sealy makes, but the Tempur part of that merger is probably what exactly you and I are trying to get whenever we need a second mattress somewhere.
John Najarian. Follow him at John Najarian on Twitter and watch him on CNBC. Thanks for joining us, friend. I appreciate it.
Much appreciated, Stephen. Thank you.
It's 12:24. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. On the phone line this afternoon is Claire Bushey. She is the law and manufacturing reporter at Crane Chicago Business. Claire, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk batteries now. You wrote a feature on the CEO, Jeffrey Chamberlain, from Volta Energy Technologies, which I think is backed by Exelon and others. But it's a venture capitalist firm, right, designed it coming up with better batteries. Is this about my iPhone or my Samsung phone, or what are we talking about here?
It will start with those things, but actually the ramifications extend far beyond your iPhone. The idea is to advance battery technology so that you can have a cheaper, lighter, more durable battery that will eventually be adopted at first by personal technology devices, but really the long-term game is for electric vehicles and a way to store renewable energy sources wind and sun.
And so the idea is we think our phones are important, but that's just small potatoes. $100 billion business in 5 years?
That's what the analysts are saying. There's huge money to be made, not to mention, you know, saving the earth, which is kind of important, too.
You can't put a price on that, Claire. So what are they doing at Volta? Are they trying to invest in technology? Are they trying to invent on their own? Or what's the goal here?
They are investing in technology. They are a mix of scientists and finance types, and they are looking around the country, around the world, to try to find companies that are at the stage where they can scale up their promising technology. And because they are science types at Volta, they are also those entrepreneurs' interface into the national lab system, which is doing sort of the best basic research that can be done on these issues. So Volta is the money, but they are also kind of the brains.
I got you. Well, what I like about this, and you were talking about Chamberlain, how he recognized that, you know, one of my beefs with businesses in this country these days is they're too interested in their quarterly dividends and not in their R&D. And that's something that Chamberlain sort of picked up on, right, in hopes that Volta can fill the gap there.
Yes, that is definitely one of his complaints as well. He thinks the model should be, you know, Bell Labs, which was kind of this storied industrial lab where, you know, it generated 9 Nobel Prizes. And CEOs just aren't funding fundamental research in that same way anymore because it's such a huge cost that they don't like to have to report that to their investors every quarter. So it doesn't get funded.
And so then how do we know if they succeed at Volta? What's their measure of success?
They would measure success incrementally. They are trying to find the thing that will scale up. And so they just made an investment in Nanoscale Components, which is a New Hampshire company that sort of is on the verge of being able to test their ideas on a factory-wide level. If they're able to do that, that would be a win for Volta.
All right. That's Claire Bushey. She writes for Crane Chicago Business. I appreciate you joining us today, Claire. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. Have a good one.
You bet. Thanks very much, Dave Schwan. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank, and we thank them for that. All right, you know, earlier in the week, we talked about AI and ethics for that. This day, we're going to talk about IA and hopefully go to school on that. On a phone line now is Nikita Javari. She is with GE, the Director of User Experience at GE Healthcare. Nikita, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hello, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy you're here because this is, I think that we're going to consider this sort of IA 101 because it wasn't anything that I'd really considered or thought much about, information architecture. And I know there's an Information Architecture Day coming up in Chicago on February 23rd. What is IA?
Interesting that you ask. Information architecture is about helping people understand their surrounding and find what they're looking for in the real world, as well as online. Let me give you an example. When you come out of the airplane and at the airport, you want to know where you are right now, and then you try to look for baggage claim. Just like that, an information architecture is about creating a structure of information, whether it's for website, application, airport, or even a restaurant menu card, and providing your users a way to get to what they need.
So
does that make sense?
It does make sense, and it's the sort of thing that, you know, I guess we just don't think of. We expect that when we get off that airplane, there's going to be a sign that tells us, but if there's not, all hell breaks loose because people are wandering all over the place. So it's one of those sort of vital things that we need that perhaps we don't give enough attention to.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best, the way it's called is you kind of sometimes miss it when you don't have it.
Right.
You get sometimes frustrated when there is no information architect present and you think that the product is bad or you get the bad feeling about the product. But when it's actually there, you don't notice it. Just like an iPhone, which has a great user experience and a great information architect because it helps you and gets you your task faster and efficient, and that's what information architecture is all about.
So this IA Day coming up in Chicago next month, or rather later this month, I guess, are we talking more online computer software architecture or still just everyday walk around the street architecture?
I think it's both, and I think this specific World IA Day, which is getting celebrated all around the world on February 23rd, it's an annual celebration that brings together designers and developers around the world. Though it could be for applications online, or it could be your next, you know, designing a restaurant menu card. Even that can be considered as an information architect.
So you're GE Healthcare, and I know you're going to be talking about the user experience. Tell me about IA when it comes to healthcare. You know, I've been back and forth, in fact, with my doctor's office today on their website, going to setting up appointments, canceling appointments, things like that. Information architecture, very important that I find my way around. I would imagine this is a real growing field when it comes to healthcare and patients.
Yeah, so I think healthcare industry is growing and it's going through a process of great transformation because we are seeing an increase in technology usage and many applications and devices which are coming along. For example, your watch, right? It's a personal health tracker. But while these innovative products are great, in order to feel confident and increase these confidence in your product, we need to ensure that there is a better user experience for end users. In order to do that, we need to create a genuine research which targets the end users, which should be carried out to provide a statistical evidence that demonstrate the desired outcome. In other words, design, particularly in healthcare, is about efficiency, usability, and better user experience for patients like me and you, as well as for those medical professionals.
Yeah, you use the word design. So, I mean, what do you study to do this? I mean, is this computer programming or is this actual commercial design? Or how is it that you become an information architect?
So there are many fields which people come from to actually enter into user experience field. One of the fields which I did my master's in is called human-computer interaction. Basically, what it does is it teaches you about how to use, computer need to know, but how to use the psychology or cognitive psychology of human and create empathy for those humans and connect those computers with the empathy and then at the end create an experience for the end users.
Fascinating thing, because when you're doing that, you're creating this empathy or this system for users of all different capabilities, right? I mean, it could be my kid, me, or my parents.
Yeah, I kind of said, funny you said that, because I call this as a superhero power, right? Why every superhero is veiled behind a mask? Because it's a comic hero, which wants you to know that at the end of the day, superhero's job is to meet the end user's need, solve people's problem. And I think of user experiences the same way. It's solving end user's problem and creating empathy around it. Programming is different. Programming is actually talks about binary code, black and white, ones and zeros. However, user experience is about connecting your products to the end users and creating a user needs and understanding those user needs.
Nikita Chavari is the Director of User Experience at GE Healthcare. Nikita, enjoy the conference later this month, and thank you for explaining it all to us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You bet. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WG. And coming up, if you want to help a poor country, give them more stuff to buy? That doesn't make sense. We'll ask Kelly Leonard about that.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. This one goes out to all of those who may just be waking up right now, and have got some news that might satisfy your sweet breakfast cravings. McDonald's has announced that it's adding donut sticks to their menu on February 20th. It's the age of sweet, crafty treats, and especially the donut market. Absolutely booming right now. This is pretty much the big chain's attempt to jumping into the water. My guess is that they went for the stick shape for the dunkability of the donuts into the coffee. That may be the charge you need to start the day off right. And e-scooters are looking for a new way to charge as well. And Chicago startup VeoRide might have figured it out. They're getting rid of the need to take the scooters off the streets and get charged overnight by using a swappable battery to give the scooter a full charge. And like where all scooters feel at home, VeoRide is testing out these battery swaps at college campuses like U of I and Northern Illinois. And with the major success of e-scooters in urban areas around the country, the rollout could be imminent. You see what I did there? Okay, I'll stop. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson, Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank on 720 WGN. Okay, I'm so excited to talk to Kelly. Well, I'm always excited to talk to Kelly Leonard.
That's nice.
The host of Getting to Yes and the podcast you can get at WGNradio.com, of course, from Second City and elsewhere. And your guest this week, I've written this book called The Prosperity Paradox.
Paradox, yeah.
And so I don't want to jump right into it, but I'm going to anyway. So the idea is, if you want to help a developing nation,
yeah,
what you need to do is, instead of what we think we need to do, is
throw money in,
right? Bring mm-hmm. big loans,
build a bunch of toilets.
What we need to do instead,
yeah,
is to give them something to buy.
Yeah, it's targeting non-consumption. And I was really blown away by this, because if for any of us who have worked in business for a long time, you're always looking at, like, how can we sell the people we're always selling to more and different?
Right.
How do we, you know, and this is called efficiency innovation, which usually involves, like, outsourcing or cutting costs or building upon the market you already have. And what they're suggesting, these authors, and it's Clayton Christensen, who's the guy who came up with disruptive innovation, and his co-authors are the ones I had on, Foso Ojomo and Karen Dillon. And what they talk about is market-creating innovation, which basically is look where people aren't consuming and then make your product accessible to them.
Mr. Leonard, just a point.
Yeah.
If you are moving into an impoverished nation, where are they getting the money to buy the things that they aren't buying now?
So there's a great story in here. So Mo Ibrahim, who is now a billionaire, he wanted to bring cell phones to Africa. And not just to the big cities. And everyone's like, you're insane. They're so expensive. And what he figured out is there's a thing now, we have phone cards. And maybe if you live in a village and you just need a 25-cent call to talk to your son once a week, that's fine. So he not only...
you're not buying the whole phone.
You're not buying the whole phone. You buy what you need. And then what he did was, in addition, this is what's so innovative about it, right, is he knew he needed to find ways to bring technology, which means he had to go to places where there weren't roads. So he had to help build roads. He basically built a bunch of businesses on his way to build his business that then other people wanted to buy what he had.
And so that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
One product, but the product has such a peripheral impact that you end up creating infrastructure in other companies.
Right. And look at America. The example of this is Henry Ford. In cars in America.
Let me read from a review, and you know this, but I just want to read it from let me find it. America in the 1850s was more impoverished than present-day Angola, Mongolia, and Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
We don't think about that.
We do not.
And what happened was Henry Ford came along and said, more than rich people need to have cars. How do I give people who don't make a lot of money cars? And so in addition to finding sort of efficiency in the factory model, he also built roads, which also spawned things like drive-ins and hotels and all these other kinds of jobs. So that really spurred growth across the entire country.
So by making cars available, again, mm-hmm. we get all of these other things.
Yep.
And but a car was a real need. Right.
Well, up until then, people found other ways to get around.
They did find other ways. I'm wondering if cell phone. Okay, here's one that's not a need, or maybe it is. Instant noodles in Nigeria.
Yeah.
So this is another example where a company went in. They introduced instant noodles to Nigeria,
which were not like no one was asking for this.
Right.
Yes.
And it became a phenomenal success.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and again, what it's discovering, and this is what these are business professors talking about solving world problems by using their smart business heads.
And by using capitalism.
Yeah, and the ideas of like, you know, hey, you don't need to be an expert in each of these areas, but what you need to be an expert in is how things run, how people think, their behavior patterns, and you can end up selling people a lot of things. We talked about this beforehand. The example at Second City, of course, was years ago when we decided to do kids classes.
Right.
We weren't doing any kids classes, and you turn around today, and our summer camps and our kids program is one of the biggest programs at Second City.
The name of the podcast is Getting to Yes, and it's up at WGNRadio.com and elsewhere. Kelly Leonard is the host. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.